This is work with TDLC member Tim Curran, who, even though he's in Boulder with me, I'd never collaborated with until 2 years ago. So that was a neat opportunity. And Matt Wilder was my PhD student, and he was funded by TDLC. And Matt Jones is our absolutely amazing colleague in Boulder, who many of you may know already. So I'll start off with a story. I got here the other day, and I went to my favorite restaurant, The Mission, and I ordered my favorite meal, Zen breakfast, except with black beans instead of the veggies, because veggies are kind of icky. And I was waiting for my meal, and I was drinking my glass of water, drink, and the waitress brought over the pitcher and poured me some more water. And I reached for my glass, and I toppled it over, and water went everywhere. And I burst out laughing, because I knew what happened. And the people in the seat next to me looked at me like I was a little weird. And what happened was that I was building an expectation of how heavy the glass was going to be. And even though I saw the waitress pour the water in the cup, my motor system was tuned up to the glass that had a certain weight with very little water. And so it just wasn't anticipating what was going to happen. We've done an experimental version of this with Alea Ahmed. She's an integrative physiology faculty member in Boulder who has this cool robot. And the robot, the person sits at this in front of this gripper and grips onto it and moves the handle around, and the robot can record where the hand goes, but it can also apply forces. So in this task, we had subjects just reach forward, but the robot would apply a force that would push them in one direction or the other, and we'd look, as a function of your recent experience, how your trajectory was affected by that experience. So these are trajectories. These are all cases where the current force is pushing you to the left, and these are all cases where the current force is pushing you to the right. But the differences in these lines reflect differences in histories of what you've experienced over the last four trials, whether the forces were to the left or the right.
Why do you need a
seatbelt? That I don't know, but it depends how viciously the robot pushes you, right? So it turns out there's a huge, huge literature on sequential effects. So here's a study of professional basketball players. It's kind of a reinforcement learning study where, I guess, I don't really understand basketball, but there's a point at which the players have to choose between taking an easy shot for fewer points or a harder shot for more points. And it turns out that as a function of your recent experience on the x-axis here, your probability of choosing the hard shot will vary. You have the same effects in finance. So if you've seen stock prices going up, 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 and you make a prediction what's going to happen next, damn thing's going to go up. And so this is your brain on a hot streak. Past returns are no guarantee of future success, blah, 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 blah. Investors' forecasts of future returns go up after the market has risen and down after it's fallen. I did a study with my colleague Tor Wager, where Tor studies pain perception, and he has people, has a hot pad administered to the skin, and you measure, you give a rating as to how painful you find these stimuli, and he does these ratings about 1 minute apart so that there's a lot of time to kind of go back to an ordinary state after the pain has been administered. And I said, I'll bet we still see sequential effects in the data. He says, no, this minute apart is enough to make it go away. And sure enough, we do. So this is sort of relative rating of pain as a function of the previous trial. So you don't need to understand all the details here, but just these curves would all be flat if the previous trial had no effect, but it does. We did a study with driving with Mohan Trivedi here at UCSD when I was out here on sabbatical, where they have this very realistic driving simulator that has sort of full-size steering wheel, full-size brake pedals, and we had subjects sitting in this, you know, sort of video game type environment. It's pretty immersive because it's a large display, and occasionally they'd get signals to accelerate with a green light or brake with a red light, and we looked at performance as a function of recent trial history and found sort of strong effects of recent history. I don't worry about what this code is, but the difference between sort of cases where the current action is consistent with your past history and inconsistent is about 90 milliseconds. And it turns out that 90 milliseconds, if you're driving 65 miles an hour, is, you know, 10, 20 feet, which is the difference between crashing into something and not. Look at that. That's the side of the building. Someone backed up, yeah. So psychologists, instead of studying all these really interesting situations, study an incredibly boring task. There's two stimuli, I'll just call them X and Y, two buttons to push, one and two, and you bring subjects into the lab and you have them do about 10,000 trials in a row. And this task has been studied since the 1950s. Where's Tom? Tom probably knows this literature, right? And all the cool math psych folks who have looked at things like accumulator models have also looked at this phenomenon because it has an interesting history and interesting effects. And you can measure the response latency, and you know, if it's an easy enough task, maybe you'll get a mean RT of 310 milliseconds, and there'll be some variability. And that variability is usually just attributed to noise, and you average over that. But you could characterize the reaction times as a function of the recent trial history. So now let me explain this coding in a little bit more detail. So if we have a sequence of trials where this is the current trial, the previous two back, and the stimuli are X's and Y's, I'll just show you the stimulus sequence. Since the response sequence is confounded with the stimulus sequence, we're not going to make a distinction. And the typical way in this field that it's coded is in terms of whether pairs of trials are repetitions of one another or alternations. So this ARAR is a way of characterizing this sequence or the mirror inverse of the sequence, the YXXYY, which, assuming the two buttons are symmetric, that you can average across those two things, right? And so when you plot reaction times as a function of that history, so here's all repetitions, and the current trial is a repetition of the past, or here's a whole sequence of alternation trials, where again, this is the oldest one, this is the most recent one, you're pretty fast. On the other hand, if you've had a lot of repetitions and now you have an alternation, so you have like an XXXXY, you're very slow, or if you have a lot of alternations, X, Y, X, Y, Y, you're slow. And then there's this pattern, which turns out to be a characteristic pattern. You see it across experiments. It looks like it could just be sort of random variability, but let's see. So I got to tell you that if you drew error bars on here, these error bars would be pretty tiny. And so these are really reliable effects. So we can ask, what's causing these sequential effects? It could be the stimulus sequence. It could be the response sequence. And I'm going to call that the first order sequence because it's the elements themselves. And with this behavioral task, we can't tease apart whether it's the stimulus or the response. But I'm going to show you evidence Tim collected with ERPs that will let us distinguish that in a minute. But before I go to there, it could be second order properties of this sequence, this repetition alternation sequence. So I can code the sequence identically with a sequence of repetitions and alternations instead of X's and Y's, and it could be the second order stimulus sequence or the second order response sequence. So we have four different codes, all of which are confounded here, and any of them could be responsible for the sequence effects that produce the variability in RTs. Yeah.
Is it embedded like right and wrong? I mean, because that also is.
These are tasks where people are almost always correct, and when you make an error, we throw out all the trial and everything sort of following it in the local context. So assume people are accurate. They're like 99 something percent accurate. If you're doing this for 10,000 trials, you get pretty good at it. Okay. So why talk about first and second order predictions? They are in one-to-one correspondence, but the predictions can diverge if you think about recency effects. So if you think about, I've just seen a bunch of alternations, what are you going to predict next? You're going to predict an alternation. So on the other hand, if you've just seen X, Y, X, Y, well, you've just seen a Y more recently than you've seen an X, so maybe you'll predict a Y. So by this first order sequence, you might weakly, if you're looking at your local history and making a prediction about what comes next, you might predict another Y. But if you've had a bunch of alternations and you predict an alternation, then you should predict an X here. And so these things can diverge. Here's another case where they diverge. If I have XXYX, I've had a lot of X's in my recent history, so I should predict an X. On the other hand, if I've had two alternations, I should predict a Y, and so I should predict a Y by the second order prediction. So these two codes, which you can map back and forth to one another, can make opposing predictions. So we came up with a model, just based on the behavioral data, called the dual priming model. And Angela isn't around, right? Okay. I don't have to give her credit for anything. I'll tell you about Angela's contribution here in a second. So the claim is that the brain predicts what's going to happen next based on the history, which is captured in two different memory traces, a first-order trace of the X's and the Y's and a second-order trace of alternations and repetitions. And we have a cute way of coding this. So the stimulus, it's either an X or a Y with plus one for X or minus one for Y. And we just have a decaying exponential memory for this first-order trace. And likewise, we have the same sort of memory where alpha and beta are these decay constants. That's saying you're taking a certain fraction of your old memory plus one minus that fraction of the current stimulus, and we build a second order memory for the alternation repetition trace. And whether we're building a trace of X's and Y's or alternations and repetitions, if you have some sequence like this, this is for the X's and the Y sequence over trials, then the memory, given a certain decay rate, you can see sort of integrates over time your recent experience. Okay? Then we say that the prediction is a weighted combination of these two traces. So we have three parameters in this model. There's the memory decay parameter for the first order, for the second order, and for this weighting. And that if you're making a prediction, response time will be fast. If your prediction matches reality because you're configuring your control system for what you're expecting, right? It turns out that this model is a very simple Hebbian learning rule. So it's equivalent to a little neural net with a Hebbian learning rate with some decay. And when you plug this model in, it does a good job of explaining data. This is from Jens's experiment, which is a little bit noisier than most of them because she has only 12 subjects in her experiment. And now I'll tell you about Angela. So this thing that says DBM2 is different than this thing that says dual priming model. So just a tiny little bit of history just to give Angela credit for things. So this is a simple neural network model. Angela's developed this nice Bayesian framework for saying, if you live in an environment which is mostly the same, but every once in a while the environment switches, we can characterize our prediction in a Bayes optimal way. And to an approximation, she found out, that model makes a prediction like this. That her model is approximately an exponentially decaying trace of recent experience. So there's this nice Bayesian characterization in terms of non-stationary environments. And then what Matt did was he went along to say, well, let's just take two of Angela's model, one of which is holding onto a first order trace and one of which is holding onto a second order trace and making predictions with that model. And that's this thing called the DBM2. Angela's model is the DBM, so DBM2 is our version of the dual priming model with the kind of Bayesian interpretation. But they're pretty much the same. That was more detailed than anyone wanted to hear. Here's a nicer experiment. This is from Cho, from Jonathan Cohen's lab, behavioral data, and they ran a really proper study, and you can see how well the model fits. It explains 98.3% of the variance. You can't really complain about that. The first order model and the second order model each contribute something to this prediction. You can see the first order model is this kind of inverted TP where it's just based on the alternation repetition pattern. And since these are sorted by alternation repetition pattern, this TP makes sense. And the first order model, it depends an awful lot on how you translate that to X's and Y's, so it's a little less intuitive. But you can see that the two add together to give you this exact shape. Okay. Side comment, that even though we explained 98% of the mean reaction time variance across these conditions, we also can explain on an individual trial basis about 25% of the variability in single trial responses with these sequential effects, which is pretty impressive, right? If you're saying, you know, people just have this intrinsic noise in their behavior, well, it'd be nice to explain away all of that noise and to be able to say that there really are systematic effects on our behavior. It's not that we just have noise generators inside our brain. And so we can get rid of about a quarter of it with sequential effects models. So now I'm going to go on and tell you about the experiment we did. Where are my time-wise?
You have
10 minutes. 10 minutes? Perfect. So this was an experiment that Tim Curran ran. And so we wanted to test our model and then also use EEG to tease apart stimulus and response processing. And we also wanted to make the experiment a little bit more interesting. So we had two conditions, one with a positive autocorrelation where there were lots of repetitions. Two-thirds of the trials were repetitions of the previous trial, and a negative autocorrelation where there's a one-third repetition rate. And so we collected the data. Here's what the data look like. The data are the solid lines with the error bars. The red is the negative condition. The blue is the positive condition. You can see that each of the curves looks qualitatively like those curves I showed you already. But what's happening here is in the negative condition, where you have a lot of alternations, you're slow if the current trial is a repetition. That's here. And you're fast if the current trial is an alternation relative to the blue condition. So people are learning something about the statistics of the trial, of the block of trials, and they're learning something that goes above and beyond the last four trials, right? Because if all that mattered was the last four trials, the red and the blue lines would be superimposed on one another. So, and it turns out that our little exponentially decaying model is enough to explain this difference. So it says, even though exponential decay, which is what happens with that that integrator memory I showed you, even though that has a fast decay, there's enough stuff going on at the tail that it can kind of build up evidence over lots of trials to hold on to statistics of the block. Or it's at least it's sufficient to explain statistics of the block. You don't need to have a short-term and a long-term learning mechanism. The two can both be accounted for with that same single mechanism. Okay, and then the dashed line is the model's prediction. The model does a pretty good job as it is, which I should have said earlier. But the cool thing about this experiment was Tim used had people with the EEG caps on, and we looked at the LRP, and forgive me for people who understand this stuff so I don't screw this up too much, but the LRP has to do with preparing a response. So these are electrodes that are sitting over a response cortex, and if you're about to push a button with your right hand, you'll get activity in the left side of cortex and vice versa. And by taking the difference in activity between the left half and the right half, or let's just say the correct half and the incorrect half so that we can deal with the symmetry, you can measure the buildup of response processing. So here, if we take all the trials and average the trials relative to the point in time at which a response is made, you see this nice buildup of activity that suggests a response is going to be made. You can also see the same thing by time locking the trials to the stimulus, and you see at some point evidence begins to integrate for forming a response. And in principle, whether you response lock or you stimulus lock, if there's just these two phases, you should end up with the same result. You don't get exactly the same result, but basically it allows us to decompose the reaction time into processing time for the stimulus and processing time for the response, right? Because if you're processing the stimulus still, you can't start building up evidence for one response or another. And once you've completed stimulus processing, then the evidence can build up for the response. So we're going to use these two measures, a stimulus-locked LRP and a response-locked LRP, to represent stimulus processing and response processing. And to a first order, they sum up to be the total observed RT. So we're able to decompose the reaction time into these two components and now understand what's going on at the stimulus side and the response side. So when we take our model and we fit just the second order trace part of the model, we get a really good fit to stimulus processing. So again, this is only three back because the data are noisier because we're using electrophysiology here. But the solid lines are the data saying, given this history, this is the time for stimulus processing is reflected by this stimulus locked LRP. And the model's predictions, sort of using exactly the same model we had before with the same time averaging constant, comes out of this and nicely fits the two conditions data. And for response processing, Matt did actually something a little bit sleazy here. He averaged across the two conditions, across the positive and negative autocorrelation conditions, because they're basically superimposed on one another, and the model predicts no difference between the two. And the curves just look noisy to have four curves that were all sitting on top of one another. So I'm just showing you two of them. But you can say, to a first order, the two conditions produce the same curve, and the model characterizes that curve nicely, but it characterizes it using the first order trace. So what's happening is that I showed you these sort of four alternatives for what sequence representation could be responsible for the sequential effects. And what turns out to be the case in the data are that it's the second order stimulus sequence and the first order response sequence. Logically, it could have been just the other way around. It could have been any way, right? There's no sort of rational story for why this is. But it's, for whatever reason, the brain seems to be picking up alternations and repetitions in stimuli, and then in responses, it's picking up the sequence of recent responses you've made. Jay?
Could you just read the y-axis for me there, tiny bit, so I know what we're talking about? 75 to 85 milliseconds.
So this is 70 to 90, and this is 120 to 240.
Okay, so the stimulus effect is much
bigger. Yeah. So we did a series of experiments. So the model predicts, and for reasons I won't get into, that if you can stretch out stimulus processing or stretch out response processing, you're going to stretch out the contributions to the total, these effects. And sure enough, we validated that. So we changed the stimulus so that it was a noisier stimulus, and you get an amplification in the contribution of the stimulus side. And same with the response side. You can also eliminate responses on some trials, and then you get the elimination of this effect in the overall behavior on subsequent trials when you have responses. And we now have like half a dozen of these sort of phenomena that are all consistent with this, and I'll tell you one of them. So in that driving task, Mohan's group is a computer vision group, so they wanted to record the foot as it moves toward the response. And so we decomposed the trial into a time from stimulus onset to the beginning of the foot moving, and the time from the foot moving to hitting the pedal. And so that's sort of stimulus processing and response processing using computer vision techniques. And it turned out that the entire sequential effect was in the response formation, and there wasn't anything we could observe in the stimulus side. So that when we just characterized the time to initiate movement, there were no sequential effects. And the sequential effect I showed you is very strong in the response formation. And because the effect was all in the response formation, the response was entirely a first-order effect. So if you just braked a whole bunch, you'd be fast if you braked. It didn't have any way of representing alternations. Okay.
Presumably that's because you aren't also, why would you expect to see a preparation to move in your foot? When you moved, you already moved. You're starting your response, right?
That's right. But you might think if it takes you longer to process a stimulus when, if you have a bunch of alternations like green, red, green, red, and you're expecting a green, maybe it will take you longer to process red, and so maybe you'd see some slowing when it came to processing that, and so there'd be longer initiation time. But we just argued that perception of green and red, since it's a natural mapping, it's just so easy that you don't really see a big effect of time there. Okay. Yeah.
So I don't know if this is a really naive question, but if you're looking at the difference between why it would be first order in your response sequences, you're actually measuring the time for each response, not the pairs. So you're really not looking for the R or the A in your response, because you need two responses to actually prime a response that's two.
But here, we're looking at the current response as a function of the previous responses. So we're coding the response relative to its context. And because of that, we are taking into account this higher order structure in the sequences. It's just that we don't find the mechanism that explains this curve isn't a mechanism that's paying attention to repetitions and alternations. It's paying attention to X's and Y's.
I'm thinking in terms of what the task is of the individual.
Yeah.
Your response system always responds to one. It doesn't. You're not planning a response to two. So there's no reason in your response system to do a second order.
But I don't see logically why you wouldn't have a response system that you would program to say, oh, do the same thing, switch, right? Just as your perceptual system appears to be rigged up to sort of detect switches and repetitions, it's like, oh, that's the same thing I saw the last trial. Why couldn't the response system be encoded with a representation that said, oh, just do the same thing again? And it doesn't seem to be. Because if it was coded that way, then we'd see effects of the second order representation. Okay. 2 minutes? All right, perfect. Yeah.
Are these third order effects?
Yeah.
So I had two R's in the recent past, so I'm gonna predict R. But it's really like a third order thing where I got AAAR.
We got really excited when we started characterizing these things in terms of first and second order, because the very natural thing is to say, maybe we can explain more of the variability when we go to third order and fourth order.
Is your x-axis a second order effect? Are you just comparing A to R?
The x-axis is just a convention for representing these things. So you can characterize a first order effect with this representation or a second order effect with this representation. So the x-axis just represents all the different sequences that could happen.
Effect is not the difference between A versus R.
Yeah,
the number of
that's
A
right.
versus the number of R. But it's this sequential effect the relationship between the A and the R.
But just think of this as a unique code for the recent sequence, right? And there's no bias in the fact that I've splayed things out along the axis with this code that I can only represent second order effects, because I can use this code to represent first order effects, which is the dark green line, or this lighter green line to represent second order effects. And it's just that when you code with regard to second order effects, you get this sort of nice shaped function if the effects are second order. So I could make a prediction for what third order effects would look like, and it's going to be another zigzaggy curve like this. And we were really hopeful that we'd get even better account, we could get this up to 100%, right? That would be pretty cool. But it turned out that we haven't been able to see any benefit, even on a trial-by-trial basis, by coding higher order stuff. So again, just empirically, no rational story. The brain doesn't seem to be encoding third order effects. So I'm pretty much out of time, but I'll tell you just sort of what we're doing in terms of practical applications with this. The Mohan's group was interested in driving because they thought, well, if we can anticipate people are going to be slow the next time, we can provide some driver assistance. But here's another practical application, and it's in the domain of judgment. And I spoke about this to at least a subgroup of people in the past, so if this sounds familiar, it's probably because you've heard me talk about this before. But suppose you ask people to make sequential judgments. I want you to make a moral judgment on a 1 to 10 scale where 1 is neither bad nor wrong, to 10 is extremely evil, of various actions like testifying falsely for pay, maybe you'd give that a 6, shooting striking workers, that should probably be an 8, poisoning a barking dog, doesn't seem so bad, 4. On the other hand, suppose I give you a sequence like keeping a dime you find, stealing a hotel towel, and poisoning a barking dog. You get these very strong context effects in judgment. And there's lots of stories about judgment that says you can't make absolute judgments. All you can do is make relative judgments. And even if you have people do this task over and over again, even if you're judging objective things like the length of a line, and you have people do this for an hour, they'll still give you these relative judgments. People just don't have the capability of doing absolute judgments. So there's psychological theories that are analogous to the choice theory that I described that help you understand how people make rating responses. So the theory I showed you said you'd have a stimulus, it does some perceptual processing, you get an internal representation, and then you do some response processing, and recent experience affects both of these. You can make the same kind of story with a rating judgment task. And if you have a good psychological model, it's a model of the contamination process. That is, I give you some sequence of impressions you have to stimuli, and a sequence of ratings you've made in the past, And I want to predict what rating you're going to make next based on the current stimulus and how it's contaminated by the recent past. But there's a dual problem, which is a decontamination problem that says, can we, if the ratings are contaminated by experience, can we decontaminate them to recover the scores that are more meaningfully related to your internal impressions? So this is a more of a machine learning problem. So you have a series of ratings over a whole sequence of trials, and you want to infer what underlying impressions led to those ratings, where each rating is based not only on the current impression, but also on recent impressions, and in these theories, also recent ratings. And so we've done this for a variety of tasks, like movie advertisement evaluation. I'm not going to tell you about the model. I'm out of time. So we show people obscure movie jackets and ask, would you like to see this on a 1 to 10 scale of from never watch this movie to can't wait to see it? So it's not exactly the Netflix task, right? It's not asking you to rate movies you've already seen, although there are sequential effects there. But it's the kind of task marketers might use to design appealing ads. So we had 50 movies, 10 from each of five genres. They were obscure films. We had people rate each movie four times, and we split the data up. So there's 50 movies, four ratings. So we had 200 trials. We split them into training and testing and split that into cross-validation to determine model parameters. So we built a contamination model from the training data, and then we used that contamination model to predict test ratings. And we're comparing our decontamination model that's learning these sequential dependencies against the baseline model that says, let's just, in our training set, we had two ratings of each movie. Let's just average those ratings and make that prediction in the test set. And we get a 5% reduction in test trial errors with the decontamination model over this averaging model that says there's no sequential structure. It's just that your ratings are noisy. Is 5% enough to matter? Well, you know, that Netflix task was about getting a 10% reduction in predictability. It also turns out we get things like we get stronger clustering of ratings by genre when you use the decontaminated ratings. So even in the non-contaminated ratings, there's evidence of clustering, but it becomes even stronger when you decontaminate. So I won't tell you about, we also did a moral judgment task and a voting task. So let me just wrap up by saying, why do we care about these sequential effects? Well, we see them as a significant source of variability in behavior, not just noise, and the goal of cognitive science should be to explain behavior in all its detail. And from Angela's perspective, these sequential effects show how adaptive the brain is to a changing environment, and it's a sort of learning that's happening on an experience-by-experience timescale, the sort of timescale that we don't ordinarily think about, like school learning. There's a whole other half to the story that I didn't tell you about in Matt Jones's work on what sort of learning mechanisms these effects show. So it turns out it's not just Hebbian learning, but it's an interesting sort of error correction learning that's going on. And it turns out that it's not just exponential decay, but there's power function decay of recent history. So it's the sequential effects are much more like ordinary memory effects that show power function decay. So there's a lot more going on there than I thought at first. And then finally, understanding these sequential effects can let us design smarter computer systems. We're talking right now to Pearson, who hire hordes of essay graders for like the SATs and ACTs and whatever. And they're very aware that these essay graders are grading a sequence of exams, and they have each exam graded by multiple essay graders. And so they're like, oh, if we can do decontamination of these grades, you know, you can even get a slight reduction and get more accurate scores. We're very interested in that. So, thank you.